Formula One is one of the most physically and psychologically demanding sports in the world. Drivers need supreme strength, endurance, and mental fortitude to excel on track. But with so much at stake and success decided by the smallest of margins, getting them ready to race is a fine art.
These athletes at this level are very unique individuals. They're extremely driven. As a result of that, might be quite emotional because you want it so much. They're stubborn. They want so much in one direction and they might not always want to listen. The skill element of it, precision that's required, navigating through the track, multiple objects in their field of vision tied together with the huge psychological pressure. Those things are very unique.
Having worked with four-time world champion Sebastian Vettel, Antti Kansas knows exactly what it takes to get an F1 driver in peak condition.
Antti, thank you for all these years. I think I've been in the best shape possible thanks to you.
I think there was a very good understanding between us on what good preparation looks like. Reflecting and growing and being open to learning new things. I think there's enough yes people for anybody at his level. I think if you're somebody who truly cares about a driver, you need to also say no every now and then and state your opinion. I made sure that he can always trust that I say how I feel.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. This week's episode is a masterclass in how to prepare a Formula One driver for the World Championship. Antti Kansas is the head of performance for motorsport at Hintze, a world-leading coaching company that specializes in F1. Immersed in the paddock since 2011, Antti started training Sebastian Buemi and then Jean-Éric Vergne before a 9-year spell with Sebastian Vettel. Antti gives fascinating insight into the key areas he focuses on. He explains why cardiovascular fitness is so important in certain races, how strength affects a driver's braking ability, and why good nutrition, sleep, and recovery are all just as essential as exercise. Away from the science, Antti tells me about the relationships he built with Vettel, Vergne, and Buemi, and the roles he played when they were going through difficult times. He talks about his previous career as a footballer in Finland's top division and shares how living in Zambia and Uganda as a child shaped his life. I also ask Antti what the future of performance in F1 looks like, and lots more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Antti, it is great to have you on the show. Thanks for your time. How are things?
Thanks, Tom. All is very well. Great to be here in the sunny Imola. Yesterday was a bit rainy, but it's good to see the sun back again.
Certainly is. Now, can we start our chat by talking about the word performance? What does that mean to you?
Performance to me would be getting your absolute maximum out when it counts. You know, we can easily get distracted by how well we do things at home, how perfect our nutrition plan has been at home, how perfect your sim session has been at home. But if you're not able to do it on the day, on the race weekend, then that's not good enough. Performance is to be able to do it when it really counts.
And then when we talk about racing drivers, how unique is their job? Is there anything else out there like being a Formula One driver?
I think there's a lot of elements that racing drivers do that are very universal and the same needs that other athletes would be having as well. You could think about the physical needs. I can go into detail about them. A lot of them are similar to other sports. And on the neck, for example, you're quite high up in the sort of spectrum of things with relative strength. Some other things are a bit less. But then there's also the unique factor. One of them would probably be the fact that you can't train your sport. We are in a sport where when the season starts, you've had 3 half-a-days of training. There's not many other sports where you could think like that. And then together with that, the concept of in the first race, the pole might be decided by half a tenth or a tenth, some hundredths. What is that? That's such an ungraspable thought at a time so small in a 5K track. And 5K, let's put that in the concept of when you're at home, from your home door, a 5K might be your way to the supermarket, to your gym or favorite restaurant and back home, what does it mean to lose a half a tenth or a hundred in that time? It's nothing. It's so easy. The margins aren't that small after three half days of practice and before that 2.5 months of no driving. So the skill element of it, the precision that's required, proprioception, understanding where in space, navigating through the track, multiple objects in their field of vision, those things are very unique, and that tied together with the huge psychological pressure and the psychological needs and the skill sets that are required in the sport, they are very unique.
I know you are Hintze's head of performance for motorsport now, but you've come from being a performance coach. So with that head on, the performance coach head, how do you prepare these guys for a season of Formula One with, as you say, just 3.5 days in the car?
It's a very good question, and I think nobody knows. How does what you do translate to the car? It's not easy, because you can't do the real sport as much as you would want to. So what we have to do is we have to break it down and start to think about it in pieces. We start thinking about, hey, there's the physical training parts, there's the nutrition parts, there's the sleep and recovery parts, there's, you know, your biomechanics, your physio part of things, injuries, general health, life management as a whole. These are things that I would call the foundational factors. They are there to allow you to just to have a stable house to build on something. They have to be in place. And that's something you do with a driver every single week, most of the days of the week, sometimes two times, so on. Then there's some specific factors. And this goes a lot into the direction of engineers as well. They will be responsible for many of these, you know. Anticipation, proprioception, that's something we can do as well, you know. How do you know where you're in space in any given moment? And then there's the racing part. That's your racecraft, racing skills, that obviously the work done with the team, but also what we might call race weekend arousal management. So the psychological side of things. So what are you doing to prepare yourself from that point of view? Are you mentally ready for the weekend?
Is F1 unique in terms of the physical and the mental needs happening at the same time? Because like a 1500 meter runner, a 100 meter sprinter, obviously the physical side of that I can appreciate, but I'm guessing the mental side isn't so important. Or am I underestimating that?
Well, I think the mental side is important in those things as well, but I would compare this more to the like of a tennis, you know, which is extremely psychological. There's a huge physical demand, but also a huge mental demand. You have to renew yourself all the time. We all know tennis, what it can be like. You know, every point is new, and you have to be able to reset when something goes wrong, recognize what's going, and then be ready to go again. You might have some things going wrong, but how do you fix that and doing that fast?
Now, how different are the drivers? Because the goal is the same for all of them, to go round a racetrack as fast as possible for 57 odd laps. But how different, how much do you have to tailor what you do to the individual? Or are you tailoring it to the sport?
It's both. So you would always do a proper needs analysis in the beginning with any client. So you need to go through testing, objective and subjective, understanding the physical levels. Where is this athlete from a cardiovascular point of view? Where is this athlete from a strength point of view? How is the nutrition habits? Are they feeding? What were the training targets, the body composition targets? Same thing with sleep, same thing with everything. You have a physio, look at the body side. So you would always do a needs analysis, and you would always tailor it to the athlete, because every person is different, every person needs different things. The end result might not be always so far from each other, but you need to understand properly first what's the starting point.
You've worked with three drivers very closely in Formula One: Sebastian Buemi, Jean-Éric Vernon, of course Sebastian Vettel. I've just got this vision of you sat across a desk asking Seb these questions, the needs analysis. Is that actually what happened?
For sure. So you would well, with Seb, obviously, luckily his old coach when I started was somebody I knew very well, and from the same company, so I had a lot of information on him already, so I had a good starting point. But for sure, you start by looking at how did you feel in the car last year, and you divide that to a physical point of view, you divide that to the mental side of things, and you might also ask how do you feel otherwise, racing wise. Is there something on the skill side, which is not my skill set, but just to understand the whole picture? That's what you would do.
What is the hardest thing for you to tailor to the individual? The physical needs or the mental needs?
Definitely the mental side. And again, I'm not a psychologist, so that's also something where you would lean on to help. But these athletes at this level are very unique individuals. They're extremely driven. As a result of that, might be quite emotional because you want it so much. They are not easy people to handle because they're stubborn. They want so much in one direction and they might not always want to listen. That's a very, very difficult skill set to be able to do.
Let's break this into pre-season and during the season now. All right, you've done your analysis of the individual. How much work do you do over the winter versus how much work do you do during the season?
So the winter would be heavily focused on the training side of things. You want to prepare and make sure the baseline numbers for every single area are high enough. And then the season would then again be a lot more about maintaining the levels you've achieved. From a physical point of view, you might be training, again, I'm saying random numbers here, but you might be training 15 hours a week, 20 hours a week in some of the biggest winter weeks. From a physical point of view, at least half the training typically would be cardiovascular training. It's a cardiovascular sport. That's the biggest demand.
Is it? I mean, I'm only trying to equate what the drivers are doing to a long-distance runner. Or just, do you know what? There's back in 1981, Jody Scheckter won a competition called Superstars, where he beat lots of different athletes, but including a 400-meter hurdler called Ed Moses. And everyone was really surprised at the time, you know, that a racing driver who sits down for a living could beat all of these different athletes. So from a cardiovascular point of view, how does that make them better in the car? I can get the strength. Do you include strength in cardiovascular?
No, so that would be a different thing. So cardiovascular strength, and then you can start thinking about some skill coordination things and such. But cardiovascular is important for, one, you need to have a high enough what we call VO2 max, so a maximum oxygen uptake. And that's for the reason that for the races such as Singapore, which is 2 hours, it's long, it's hot, it's challenging in every way, you need to have a high enough top line so that you don't run into trouble there and you can maintain your attention throughout the whole race. That's one thing.
What are the BPM figures for a general driver? Are we seeing over 200 beats per minute or is it less than that?
It's less than that.
Because they're so fit.
You have to be. So there's that. But then another thing about endurance is that you have to have a foundation of endurance. So I just spoke about the top end, but you need to have all this foundation level on how effective, efficient your cardiovascular system is. That's something that you need to be able to recover between every single race and manage this crazy life that you have to lead as a Formula One driver. If your foundational level is not high enough, you're going to be too much time on the higher levels, and then when it comes to the mid end parts of the season, you just are not recovering between the races and end up being sick. We know how difficult that end of summer is when you've crammed so many races together and you're waiting for that break, or the autumn time with the big jet lags and the big Faro races. To be fresh there when the championships are decided, you need to be putting a lot of minutes on the bottom levels as well.
What are you doing to lay those foundations? What kind of work?
From a cardiovascular point of view, that would be lower intensity running. It could be swimming, it could be cycling, it could be cross-country skiing, any of those things. But you need to know, understand your body, understand your thresholds. So there's they're called LT1 and LT2. It's essentially understanding how your energy metabolism works. You need to know where your body is and then know that the training you're doing is feeding towards that foundational endurance as well.
Okay, from a strength point of view, the neck, obviously.
Yeah.
Where else are you looking for strength?
The strength levels, you would be thinking about your braking leg.
What kind of numbers have you got there? What sort of pressure are they having to put on the brake pad?
Around 80 kilos.
Wow.
That might be a peak pressure. So that's what it might be. But again, a small angle, and it's a very small movement, and it's only a ball of the foot. Well, the very first thing about braking, of course, from a driving point of view, is that it's about the feeling. Braking is never the same for every corner because it depends on the grip you're having. But from a physical point of view, you would be thinking about what's the peak force you might be able to put, how fast do you get to that peak force, because that's a different capacity, and then perhaps for racing, how well you're able to modulate and go into something and hold. But ultimately, as a training point of view, you just need to have a certain level of lower body strength that you're able to produce when for braking, and you're able to produce it consistently. depending on the grip you have available.
What is fascinating is how fast technology moves right now. You've been involved in Formula One since 2011. How has the tech moved on in the time that you've been involved, and has it allowed you to do different things today that you weren't able to do 10, 15 years ago?
In the car, obviously, you're not, everything that you wear has to be FIA homologated. So in the car, we can't do too much for that reason. At home, there's a number of different things you can do. You see quite a few drivers wearing Oura Rings, for example, or different other sleep trackers to understand your sleep, understand how well you recover for their boy. You're looking at your resting heart rate overnight. You're looking at your heart rate variability overnight. A number of these things, that space has moved on immensely over the last 10, 15 years. There's a lot of different training gadgets, not gadgets, but different devices that can provide you more accurate information on where the driver is. The usability / do you really need them always is questionable, because it's ultimately still about doing some very good foundational basic work week after week and being very consistent. That's the thing that brings the biggest benefits in this sport. If you start running after every technological advancement, you easily end up going, 10 meters one way and then, changing directions the other way. So for me, I think the main thing is to keep focus on what you really need to be doing week after week and not make it too complicated.
And that's where your experience comes in. And when I was looking at the Hintze website before speaking to you, the circle of life model that you guys promote, there are six facets. General health, you listed them a minute ago actually, but general health, nutrition, mental energy, biomechanics, sleep and recovery, and physical activity. I'm probably asking for myself as much as anything actually, but is there a hierarchy among these? If it's very difficult for people listening to this to apply all of those to their daily life. Is nutrition the most important thing? Is sleep the most important thing? What would you advise?
You need all of them. A traditional way, like historical way of doing that or coaching in many fields has been that you might just hire a physical trainer. And then they look at how you train. You might even train two times a day, but that might be 3 hours of your day. What's happening on the rest of the hours? If you want to reach your goals, you need to understand what's happening on your full day, on your full week, on your full month, your full year. If you don't look at nutrition, you don't know if the athlete is first of all fueled enough to be ready for the training you're doing. And consequently, after the training, doing something that he actually recovers and builds whatever capacity he needs to build. If he's not sleeping well enough, he's not also recovering from the sessions. He's not preparing himself for the race. If there's a general health issue, that blood testing shows that, hey, your low iron levels or low vitamin D levels, it's no surprise that you might be low in energy. You might be getting repeated sicknesses. If there's a movement issue, something that's limiting you and giving you pain all the time, that pain is not allowing you to train. So then again, that's stopping you from doing things. And the same thing for all of those things. So you need to have an eye on all those things, understand what's the stress of the person as a whole, because only then you understand why you might not be going forward.
If people want to live their lives like a Formula One driver, can we break this down even more, right? So for nutrition, for example, to lead your best life, what would you advise people to be eating?
It comes down to the basics. I don't think we need to overcomplicate. I think we often start following fad diets and going a number of directions, and we lose focus after a week or two, or sometimes after 2 days, and then we change direction. It's a clarity on what you are after. And then most of the time, the solution is eating very good, healthy foods day after day. We all know what the unhealthy foods are most of the time. It's just you have to be doing day-to-day good choices, good foundational choices. We can start building on that a number of things, but unfortunately, as boring as it sounds, that's most of the time the answer.
Are we allowed guilty pleasures?
Yes.
I mean, do you eat chocolate?
Yes.
You do?
I do.
You live in Switzerland.
You have to.
Okay. And in terms of sleep patterns, how important is the magic 8 hours?
It's important. It's a good target. I think we all know that there's a tiny bit of individuality always, but that 8 hours, 7.5 hours is a very good target for everybody. We both know, because we lived this life for a long time, that in this job it's often difficult to get it. But we can build in very good habits to make it happen. There's a few things to think about. There's one thing is regularity. So try to go to bed always in the same time, every single night.
Yeah, but that is incredibly hard for a Formula One driver to do because of the travel.
Correct.
And the jet lag.
Correct. However, you can still do a good job and not give up on it. So it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try. So at home every single time, and then having a really well thought through jet lag plan to be able to do the same thing wherever you're going next. You can pre-adjust a little bit, but then once you're there, getting into it again and having a clear plan on what you should be doing.
What is a jet lag plan? Can you help me? So, we're going to Australia, right? Time difference is 10, 11 hours.
First things first, several months before, you'd be already looking at what are the flights that are available? What is the flight that I might want to take that would fit in the best way for the location where I'm flying from? And then after that, it's a case of understanding, okay, race is here. We haven't been there before. It's our first time there. Or what's your previous experience with jet lag? And then from there, you decide, when do you fly? Do you fly on the Sunday? Do you fly on the Monday? Do you fly on the Saturday before the race? And then you might start thinking after that about, okay, what are the 3-2 days before you fly? Do you start adjusting pre-flight? And what are the sort of days after the flight? How do you manage the days there? How do you put training into those days? How do you manage nutrition on those days? Everything, essentially. Is there marketing events those days? Can you work with the team to decide when should those be taking place so that we make sure the energy is at its highest for the race? And so on and so on and so on. That's the level of detail you need to be going if you want to really optimize this process.
And in terms of physical activity, people talk about 10,000 steps a day, don't they? Although I do actually believe that was some marketing campaign for a car company in Japan. That's actually where that came from. But is there a magic number that people listening to this should be trying to achieve to live a good, healthy life?
There is a reasonable amount of evidence about the 10,000 steps, and it's definitely not doing any harm for anybody. So it's a healthy target to have. What is very clear is that exercise is one of the most potent drugs that there is. And I'm quoting a doctor by saying this, but it is so powerful as a tool for essentially everything. So your longevity, your health, it overrides a lot of other naughty habits that you might have. It is just the most powerful thing there is. And doing that 3-4 times a week is probably going to do a good for every single one of us.
Can we talk about some of the drivers you've worked with now? Okay, so you come into the sport in 2011 with Sebastian Buemi. Can you tell us how the opportunity came about and what kind of a driver Sebastian was to work with?
The opportunity came through Aki. So he got in touch with me through a mutual colleague. It was a coincidence. I wasn't expecting it, but I was obviously very pleased to get the call. I went to see him in Switzerland, and he happened to like me. And then things evolved very fast, and I found myself soon living in Switzerland working with Sebastian Buemi.
That's Aki Hintzer, who founded the company, of course, that you're now head of performance for. But word on Aki then, before we come back to Sebastian. I met him several times. I actually ran the Nürburgring Nordschleife with him, would you believe it? What struck me about him in the meetings I had with him is that he was very calm. Physically, he didn't look like a man who'd spent his life in the gym either. There was no sort of, I didn't feel intimidated by him. Do you think that was one of his strengths?
100%. As I said, drivers are driven and very emotional often. So I think part of Aki's success with drivers and team personnel also was his disarming, unmoralizing feeling that he gave to everybody. He's able to break that barrier, break that emotion that people might be having on, and move on very quick from there into logical solutions. People weren't afraid of him, and they felt safe talking to him. And then he was able to provide very logical models on how they should be solving their problems. On that moment then, but also automatically later on when they might appear. He was just an incredible mentor in this regard. And as much as he was not a psychologist, he is the best psychologist I've ever met.
And from a business point of view, just talking about the company, when he passed away so tragically back in 2016, how difficult a moment was that for Hintze, the company, or were you fully established and there were no dramas, if you like, about the continuity of the company?
For any company who would lose somebody like Dr. Aki, it would be an immense negative thing to happen. However, we had a really good doctor to continue his work. We had really good coaches in place to continue the work. So we did manage to get on the feet very fast following that. And I think what we also managed to do very quick is maintain still that psychological touch that Aki always had with drivers and bring a new person leading that work for us. It's always been our USP. We're known for being able to connect with drivers well and try to influence them in the best possible way.
What I find so extraordinary about that is that, okay, you had your own career, you were a footballer, but you've never been a racing driver yet. And I think that applies to all of the coaches that work for Hintze in this paddock. So how and why do you think you are able to create that connection with drivers?
That's a very fair point. It's not easy, because if you don't understand the sport, there's some challenges to be overcome. But I think we have a very robust understanding on what we should be working on. So that's, again, for all the levels. So we have so much experience from other sports and also yet now legacy in this sport that we know where to start from. And then we start the process the very logical way. Again, starting from the needs, and that includes also the psychology. And then understanding from there, okay, what's the priority? What's the piece of work we have in our hands here? And then starting to create logical solutions on how to get out of there. And involving the driver in this process. It's not an authoritative one-way street. It's always going to be a two-way street. And that's the way we try to operate.
So part of your job is as a motivator?
For sure. Is it a motivator? Is it just some kind a trusted person who somebody can speak to? Is it somebody to help you create clarity for yourself? I think clarity is one of the big words. The engineers are the big players here in terms of everything to do with the car. We have nothing to do with that. But we might sense when the driver is nervous, or when the driver is puzzled, is not really clear on what he should be doing. We might sense that and try to help them get back on the feet from there.
Which brings us back to Sebastian Buemi, because when you worked with him in 2011, that was actually his final season in Formula One. So I'm guessing it was a difficult moment for him professionally. A bit of a baptism of fire with you to work with him in those conditions?
So when I started with Sebastian, he had a difficult 2010 year. It was not matching with his expectations. And then I came in with the stance to, first of all, raise some of the physical metrics, try to help in a big holistic way. And that was a big challenge for me, obviously new into the sport, but I think we did a bloody good job in that winter. There's news articles of him putting quite a few kilos that winter, and we worked extremely hard and we had a really good connection. And Sebastian is still a good friend of mine, so I hope we agree on that. And that sort of boost in the physical thing, along the side that I think he himself also worked really hard on himself. I believe we had a good year. Particularly the start of the year was strong. We were points in Australia straight away. We had Turkey, I think it was eighth place in the first half. Of course, we had some bad luck. It's always everybody's fault. And unfortunately, the year didn't end well for him, and he had to give up his space. But I think he's shown elsewhere after that what a fantastic driver he is, because he has world champions on his belt.
So you swap to Jean-Éric Vergne the following season. How much time do you need when you get a new driver? Talk us through the process of getting to know that person. And by the time you turned up in Australia in 2012, did you feel that you and Jean-Éric had the connection you wanted, or did it take longer?
I learned a lot over those 2 years with Jean-Éric. I think he's a very interesting person, a very kind and generous person. But also, he came into F1 with a lot of expectations, like many people who come through the systems. He'd won essentially everything, or been in the podiums for an all series, and then suddenly you come into F1 to a car that at that time couldn't fight for podiums, and we were in 15th place and fighting to get through Q1 and such. It's not an easy place to be for somebody who's expecting so much. And then how do you measure your performance when you're used to measuring by wins? So it's a good example of a driver, and I think anybody in that position, how do you stay mentally in a good place and don't let the results define you as a person? That's a huge challenge, and it's a challenge for everybody in this sport.
And it was an interesting time, wasn't it? Because we knew quite early in 2013 that Mark Webber was going to retire, and I think it was quite clear to people within Formula One that it was either going to be Jev or Daniel Ricciardo that was going to get bumped up to the big team the following season. Did you see a change in Jean-Éric when that became clear, or did he just carry on as he had before?
I think with as a Toro Rosso driver, you always hope to get that Red Bull seat. I think now, if I was to look back, I would think about those first years more of as a process. There's so much to learn in those first years when you come from a younger category. The whole F1 world is completely new. There's so much more data. There's so many more things to think about. There's so much more that people expect from yourself. There's so many interactions, and you also expect it to be suddenly, in many ways, a leader. You don't need driver coaching anymore. You are F1 driver. You're one of the 20 best in the world. I think to answer your question, yes, for sure, he was thinking about it, and everybody would be. But I think you need time to be ready for that seat.
You then move in 2014 to work with Sebastian. Were you sad to be leaving Jev? Because he was still in Formula One that year.
For sure. It was a hard conversation.
Are you leaving a work colleague or are you leaving a mate? Just how close do you get in your role?
Both. I think we had a great relationship and he's very kind and generous. And I think people often misunderstood him as he came across to some as a little bit cocky, but that's not the truth in any way. So it was not easy. However, I was put in a new challenge, and I was, of course, looking forward to that as well.
Well, let's talk about Sebastian, because, you know, you worked with him from 2014 right through to the end. And people listening to this may remember his radio message on the slowdown lap in Abu Dhabi after his last race. And you were one of the people he thanked.
Antti, thank you for all these years. I think I've been in the best shape possible, thanks to you.
First of all, describe the relationship you had with Sebastian Vettel.
I'll answer it from my point of view. You might have to ask it from Seth for his opinion, which might differ or might not. I would label him as a friend right now. I don't work for him anymore. I think there was a very good match in values with us and a very good understanding between us on what good preparation looks like. It means turning every single stone there is every single day. Sometimes that's the rest day, by the way. So it's not every day is pushing day. It means reflecting and growing and whatever happens, having the ability to do that and being open to learning new things. I think we both shared those things, and that's one of the things that I felt made our working relationship very good, because we were open to critique to each other. Both of us staying quite hard back to each other, because that's what learning is. And that's also what keeps me honest. I think there's enough yes people for anybody at his level. There's enough people who want to please him. I think if you're somebody who truly cares about a driver, you need to also say no every now and then and state your opinion. It's then up to him what he decides to do after. But I made sure that he can always trust that I say how I feel.
And would he question a new training regime? Would he question a new diet? Did he question everything, I suppose?
100%. I think everybody in this paddock who knows him, who have worked with him in a team, knows that he would ask, why on earth are we doing this? Why are we doing this? Tell me specifically why this makes me better. So that's something he would do every single day.
You say the relationship became very close. You consider him a friend. He moved teams on several occasions while you were working with him. Would you discuss those moves? You know, did you discuss going from Red Bull to Ferrari, from Ferrari to Aston Martin, or was that a side of the business that you just left to him?
That's his business. If he talks to me about it, I would listen, but it's his business, and it was not something I would have been a part of.
What about the difficult moments, right? There were great moments. The first win for Ferrari, he said, was the most special when he came on the podcast. But what about the bad moments, like the crash in Hockenheim in 2018.
Sebastian Vettel, he has been leading almost from start to finish, but now is out of this race. A massive disappointment for the championship leader, who was on his way potentially for his first ever victory in Hockenheim, but has ended up in the barriers.
For sake. Sorry, guys.
What was your role in picking Seb up again?
Give him space. Be somebody who he can trust. I think there was a lot of people beating him up on those days. You don't need to be one more person like this. It's a little bit, what would Aki do in this situation? It's difficult enough to be in that position. At Hockenheim, crash is such a simple, small thing that took place. Why did that happen? It's so marginal how that goes wrong or right. I don't think he needs another person blaming him on anything. What I try to do in those situations is provide clarity and support on it, know how do we go forward from there.
Do you think you'd be any better or wiser in your job if you'd been a racing driver, so that in moments like that, you can relate to what's going on the track?
Maybe, but then again, there are other people around, engineers who might have a long history on that side of things. So there's a lot of people who can guide him on driving, on data and other things that are not my thing. So could it help me as well? Maybe it would, yeah. But then again, would I have done the same training as I have done now to be in this position? I probably wouldn't.
Let's talk about your own career path now. You talked about the meeting with Aki Hintzer and how that helped you get into Formula One initially. But I want to take you right back, first of all, because you spent part of your childhood in Africa. How did that experience help you in what you're doing today? Did it at all?
I think it did. When I got this job initially, I was not as experienced as many people who come here right now are. I got it as a reasonably young practitioner. And I've wondered every now and then, why did Aki trust me to do the job? And what did he see me in me that could make me a good practitioner in this environment? And I think part of those things relate to the fact that I have quite a good perspective on what's going on in the world. I've seen from a young age in Africa what life can be like. You need a lot of calmness and humbleness in this environment. Like I said, there's enough people in the paddock like this with drivers who are earning a lot of money who want something from them. As a coach, you can't be one of those people. You need to be somebody they can trust and who's stable in all conditions and doesn't appear as he's trying to use the driver in any way. And I think on those characteristics, I've throughout my career tried to be very strong and somebody they can always know that is going to be constant.
So it's as if your experience in Africa has given you some emotional intelligence that not everybody in this paddock has, right?
I don't want to compare myself to others, but I think it perhaps was helpful for me. Yeah. I've seen a number of countries when I was a young child already due to my parents' work, and that perhaps combined with my personality is, I guess it would have been helpful, but I think we should ask that from Dr. Aki himself, but unfortunately we can't.
Whereabouts in Africa were you? Which country?
I lived in Zambia when I was 3 years old for a few years, and then I lived in Uganda later on as well.
And at what point did Formula One come onto your radar? Did you watch it as a kid?
As a Finn, you always watch Formula One. I think on the times of Mika Häkkinen, we had half the whole population in Finland or such watching the start of the races. And we in Finland, we are 5.5 million people. You know, when 3 million people are in front of the TV watching Mika start, it's quite a big deal and people talk about it. So you do watch Formula One.
And you weren't tempted to try and get yourself into a go-kart somehow and have a go?
No, I mean, my sport was football.
Yeah, wait, I was going to come on to that.
So yeah. This is something I had played from a young age, and I come from Finland, so I know people. The reputation of Finland in football is not the same as England. So I'm going to say the next thing with a pinch of salt. But I tried my best, and I have international experience with youngsters, and I've played also a match in the Finnish top league. So I think I know what football is about in some way.
Striker, defender. What was your position?
Right winger, who then with age went to right fullback.
But there were a lot of injuries, weren't there? And is that what ultimately ended your football career?
Yeah. Plus a desire to look for something that perhaps brought me then more satisfaction at that moment and a bigger purpose, so which led me to go study in UK. So I studied in Loughborough to start with, did my bachelor and master's there, and then later on I've also done another master's at St. Mary's.
Did you benefit from being around a lot of sports people at Loughborough? Because it is a very sporty university, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. So numbers of high-level athletes that are coming there every day. UK Athletics were training there a lot. You have Olympic level athletes training next to you in the gym. You're interacting with the coaches who are there working with them. It's a great environment to learn and see what good looks like. And that's what this job is about. Always knowing what good looks like on every single level of the Better Life model.
Back to the Better Life model.
Exactly.
And with your football hat on, do you get a bit frustrated watching the All-Stars charity football game before the Monaco Grand Prix every year? Although Alonso is actually quite good. Credit where it's due.
I have actually never watched it. That's the thing. Maybe it's protection for me, you know. However, I have to say that I it's been quite a few years I haven't played now, and I went to play last spring, and one of the guys, it's, you know, Laura, a fun game. One of the guys said, "You should be better than that." So I think I should play a bit more often nowadays.
So you then, you know, as you say, you qualify at Loughborough University. Then fast forward to the meeting with Aki, you get involved in Formula One as a performance coach. You're now head of performance for motorsport. You're the senior guy for Hintze here in the Formula One paddock. What does the job entail now? Are you actually hands-on with any individual drivers, or is it more of a management role across the paddock?
It's very much a management role. So I'm responsible for our service in motorsport, with a particular focus on the top categories, F1, F2, F3. I try to make sure that, first of all, what we offer our drivers is the very best that the driver can get. If they receive something better somewhere else, I'm disappointed. I want that what we offer is the best in class. We have a number of staff involved in this environment. I'm managing them. And then try to innovate the best I can to make sure we keep up with the new needs that are coming all the time.
How many drivers are you looking after in this paddock today?
I prefer not to speak,
oh, really?
Speak numbers. It's okay. I think what I've learned over the years is that don't want to take advantage of any driver, and I prefer humbleness on this. But we have a significant presence, and always had, on different paddocks.
Okay, but it's more than one, isn't it? We can say that.
Yes.
So do you get your performance coaches here? Are they always talking to each other about how to innovate, how to improve, or are they little islands in their own teams?
Well, the funny thing is that we obviously have coaches working for different drivers in different categories, and drivers are always competing against each other. So there's always an element of not sharing, because you are looking for the best of your own driver. You have to do that. However, what we try to do is that we offer a very, very extensive educational program, a monthly program with the elite level speaker on a theme that we believe moves the needle in this environment. And that is always continued by a higher level discussion after by all the practitioners. Nothing private is ever shared, and no solutions that relate to any driver have ever discussed, but that's the way which we try to progress on the field.
And is Hintze involved in other elite sports?
We have involvement also in other sports, but motorsport is definitely our majority of our business.
I feel like I've gone back to university. It's been really fascinating to speak to you. I did want to end it just by throwing it forward. Where do you think the big innovations are going to come down the line? Is AI somehow going to help you in what you do, or are there other avenues?
I think the shift that is happening, and that has happened in the last years, is that many performance coaches have in the past worked as a bit of a siloed approach and seen as the driver's entourage. However, I think now they're starting to be seen much more as a professional who has a unique skill set and a very strong skill set who the teams can also rely on and work collaboratively. So not only do you have an aligned approach on the human performance side, aligning nutrition, training, and all those things, but the gold standard is when the engineer and the coach also have an aligned approach of who the driver is and how can we best help him. If they don't talk to each other, then you're missing a big point of the whole puzzle. If there's something that the driver needs and he needs to be supported on, there needs to be joint messages from different directions and a joint understanding that how do we as a team help you. So that's a big direction of travel that we believe in strongly.
Do you actually help the teams as well? When you were at Ferrari with Sebastian, did you find if there was an issue with one of the mechanics, one of the engineers, would you step in, or do the teams carry their own doctors and physios with them?
So we provide services also to teams. So we have that element as well, definitely. As an individual coach with working in a team as a driver, with a driver, you would certainly help the team as well if they need help. But like I said, that's also a separate service we certainly are involved in. We have doctors, nutritionists, number of services on that front.
Can I end this now with our usual quick fire questions, which I ask everybody? What else are you good at? And you can't say football.
Mountain biking.
Is that how you relax on a day off? Is your life a very physical life?
Less now with the child in my life. But training is definitely a part of my relaxation routine, yeah.
Which racing driver, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
Sebastian Vettel.
What, because he'd find a way of mending the lift?
Probably. He's a funny guy. Even after all these years, he's a really funny guy. So if you have to spend a lot of time with him, he'd probably figure out some story and talk about it for 5 hours. And then by that time, we'd be clear.
One more thing on Sebastian. When you've led the life that he has and won all those races, won all those world championships, how difficult is this sport to let go? When he retired, has he been able just to move on, or has he actually asked you for a little bit of help just to help him wind down and get used to what we might call civilian life?
He's a very smart individual, and he has a lot of different projects that he's very interested in and involved with. I think he has such a world of opportunities that the biggest struggle for him is probably choosing the one he really wants to do most.
All right, next one. Who would play you in a film?
That's a tough one. I was just trying to think of a composed Finnish actor, but you wouldn't know those people.
But the Finns listening to this.
There's a Finnish director called Aki Kaurismäki, and there's a film called Fallen Leaves that's come out. I went to watch it with my wife. Half the movie is silent, and it's very Finnish humor. So probably one of those characters there. I'm not that quiet as they are, but from a principal point of view, it would probably be one of those.
Actually, on the topic of movies, the Brad Pitt movie is being made as we speak. Did anyone from the movie consult you about the role of Hintze in Formula One, just for some advice on...
Actually, they have a coach who used to be working with us a number of years ago who has been consulting them. So he has had... There's a Hintze affiliation there, but we are not directly involved.
Okay, no, that's interesting. Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
Very cliche, but probably my wife.
And who would be your first guest if you hosted a podcast?
If it was still possible, Dr. Aki Hintze.
Knowing what you know now, is there one question that you would ask Aki now?
I would ask him again a very basic question, just to understand what performance means for him. I asked him a question when I was with him, who's the most impressive athlete he's ever dealt with? And his response was Haile Gebrselassie, because he said the amount of joy and lightness that he was able to maintain in his life while training hours and hours every day of monotonous running, still maintaining a spark in your eye where no small problems trouble you in any way, and you're able to just keep focused and enjoy life on the moment, that's quite impressive. And that's what Aki noted to me in those days. And I would be very keen to ask similar questions from him again with the perspective that I might myself now have after all the years in the sport.
Antti, that's been brilliant. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. It was a great pleasure.
Former Olympic gold medalist Haile Gebrselassie, a bit of a hero for all athletics fans and a role model. As I might add, is Antti. He's brilliant at what he does and so calm and goes about his work with a twinkle in his eye. I thought that was a fascinating chat. So much is said and written about the importance of driver fitness and well-being, and I enjoyed learning more about it from an expert, the expert. Thanks, Antti, for your time, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. And please let me know your thoughts on what Antti had to say via all the usual means, as you did after last week's show with Carl Wendlinger. We had loads of feedback, including this from Ben Waterworth. An amazing chat with Carl Wendlinger. I've always felt that of the famous Mercedes Junior trio from the late 80s, his story has never been heard, and it was great to fill in the gaps. Thanks, Tom, for an amazing interview with him. Well, thank you, Ben, for getting in touch. And I, too, loved hearing Carl's story. Well, that's almost it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget that F1 Nation's review of the Monaco Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Diego Mejia in the Monte Carlo paddock, and we reflect on that historic victory for Charles Leclerc. I will, of course, be back next week with another special guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.